And B. Kennet never understood. To dress as a fine little man in a lace shirt and serve Igrot at table, just so the pirate could later batter him and rip the garments from his body. Kennet was the one who took a hatchet to my face. Did you know that? I held him in my hands as he did it. Igrot laughed as he chopped my eyes away. It was our bargain. Kennet would blind me, and Igrot would not rape him again. But Igrot never kept his word to anyone about anything. But we did. Oh, how we kept the promises we made in the dark and bloody nights. I heard the ship grind his teeth together. The wave of emotions that assailed me made my heart thunder and my breath come short. I wondered that Althea and Brashen did not come running. The ship spoke to my thought. Oh, they guess and suspect, but they do not know all that happened on my decks. Neither are they privy to our conversation now. All those years, with my body trapped as a ship and my mind trapped as a battered boy. Until the day we killed them. He poisoned them all, with chips of my face ground and mixed into their soup. And when they were all sickened, all groveling and clasping their bellies and too weak to stand, Kennet finished them. With the same hatchet he'd used to take my eyes, he took their lives, one by one, and their blood and memories soaked into my decks. Every man who had watched him, shamed and humiliated, felt that hatchet. And Igrot, last of all, so lovingly, he dismembered him. So I have all those memories too, Buckman. He stopped speaking for a time. He turned his back to me and stared out over the water. Can you imagine, human, to have a young creature you love endure such things as you stand helplessly by, unable to kill his tormentor without killing him? Over and over I took his memories. Twice I took his death and held him safe until he could bear to return to his body again. I could dim those memories for him, but I could not erase them. His voice became oddly distant, as if he spoke of events that had happened 100 years ago. Kennet could not bear to keep those memories. He would have had to kill himself. So he killed me instead. We agreed to it. I no more wanted to live with the memories than he did. We killed them all, one by one, and Igrot, last of all. Then Kennet gathered a fine share of the loot that was on board, scuttled me, and watched from the ship's boat as I listed and took on water and finally capsized and sank. I tried to die. I thought I would die. But I do not need air, and I do not need food. I hung there, upside down, under the water. The waves pushed me about, and then a current caught me. And when I realized it was bearing me home, back to Bingtown, I let it. And so eventually they found me, hull up in the mouth of Bingtown Harbor, a hazard to navigation. They dragged me in to a beach, pulled me up out of reach of the tides, and chained me there. The mad ship. The pariah. And there, Brash and Trell, and Amber, and Althea found me. There were stars in the clear night sky above us, and he cut smoothly through the waves, propelled by a light but constant wind. We could have been the only two living things in the world. The young man stretched on the deck had not moved, and I wondered if Paragon held him under, immersed in sleep. I wondered how much of this tale he would share with Kennetson, and why he had shared it with me. "I will give him none of it," the ship told me. "When I go as dragons, it will all go with me." "Do you think the human memories will vanish when you become your dragons?"
"No,"
he spoke with certainty. "The memories of dragons and the recall of the serpents that go between the egg and the dragon are what make us whole. We forget nothing, not if we are properly cased and hatched. I will shake off this ship's body and the shape of your flesh, but always I will carry with me the horror of what humans can do to one another for amusement." I found I had little to say to that. I looked down on the sleeping young man. So he will never know what his father went through? He knows enough of it. What little Etta and Wintrow and Sorkor knew, he knows. He need not bear the actual memories. Why should he know more of it than that? To understand what his father did? Oh, does knowing what the child Kennet endured make you understand what the man Kennet did? I listened to my heart beating. No, nor I, nor would he. So why burden him with it? Perhaps so he would never do likewise. That bit of dragon womb the lad wears strapped to his throat, carved in his father's likeness, was worn by his mother for many more years than Kennet. She spent her childhood as a whore. Can you conceive that she thought of Kennet as the first person to treat her with kindness? That she came to love him for saving her from that life? "I did not know," I said quietly. "Believe me, Kennetson knows more of rape than he would care to admit, and I doubt he will perpetuate upon others what his mother regards with abhorrence." He took in air and sighed it out, a sound like waves on fine sand. "Perhaps that was why his mother bound it so tightly about his throat before she allowed him to board." Kennetson stirred. He rolled over, opened his eyes, and stared wordlessly up at the sky. I held my breath and stood motionless. The cloak was not a perfect protection. It took on the texture and color and seeming dimension of whatever was behind me, but the wind was ruffling it, and I suspected that would look peculiar. Still, he did not look toward me. He spoke to the sky, or the ship.
"I should have been born on these decks. I should have grown up here. I've missed so much."
"We both have,"
Paragon replied. His voice was kindly.
"There is no going back, my son. We will take what we have now and keep it with us forever."
"When you turn into dragons, you will leave me."
"Yes,"
Kennetson sighed.
"You didn't even have to think about it."
"Any other answer would be impossible."
"Will you come back to visit, or will you just be gone, forever?"
"That I don't know. How can I possibly know?"
Kennetson sounded very young as he asked,
"Well, what do you hope you will do?"
"I think I will have to relearn how to be a dragon, and there will be two of us, me and yet not me. I cannot speak for what happens after. I can only say that for the days we have left together, I will be here with you." I ghosted away. That conversation was not for me. I had enough pain of my own without hearing another child abandoned by a father. I had stayed too long with the figurehead. It might be that both Amber and Spark would be sleeping. I moved across the deck in a series of pauses, avoiding the crew. In the dark of the companionway, I stood outside the door and silently removed the cloak. I gave it a shake and carefully folded it. I tapped lightly on the door 3 times. No one spoke, so I eased it open. The fool was supine on the floor. A faint light came in the porthole, just enough to distinguish him there.
Fitz!
He greeted me amiably. I looked down at him and then at the upper bunk. No Spark?
On duty tonight. So, the butterfly cloak again?
How did you know?
I heard the snap of fabric outside the door. I guessed it was the cloak, and you just confirmed it. Where were you spying?
I wasn't. It's one way to be alone, to be invisible, even when there are others nearby. But I did spend some time with Paragon.
That's a dangerous pastime. Stand clear, please.
I moved until my back touched the door. He brought his knees quickly up to his chest and attempted to vault to his feet. He failed, crashing sideways into the bunk with a force that would leave bruises. He made not a squeak at the pain. Instead, he slowly stood and then sat on the bunk.
Not quite able to do that yet, but I will.
I know you will, I said. If will alone could make a thing be, the fool could master his old tumbler's tricks. I pulled my old pack out from under the bed. Reaching inside, I found the Elderling firebrick and made sure it was upright before I tucked the folded cloak beside it. I reached past my folded clothing and Bee's books. The tubes of silver I felt through the shirt wrapping them. Shade's exploding pots in the very bottom. As I resettled everything securely, I asked lightly, "Any more dreams, fool?" He made a dismissive sound. A moment later he said,
"I should have known that Paragon would be aware of my dreams. What did he tell you?"
"Nothing about what you dream, but he did share with me, in an impressively vivid manner, a bit of what shaped Kennet." I wedged my pack back under the bunk in an upright position and sat down beside the fool. I had to bow my head to fit. What monsters humans are. I'd rather be a wolf. He surprised me by suddenly leaning on me.
Me too.
After a moment, he added,
"I'm sorry. I've been angry with you. That wasn't fair. But it also wasn't fair for you to doubt my dreams. Have you touched minds with Bee again?"
"No. I've tried several times, but I can't find her. I must be so careful. Shade is out there, raging like a storm. Twice he has come at me, demanding I join him. At first I sensed Nettle there too, and the coterie, trying to bring him under control, to confine him to his body. The last time, I didn't sense them at all, but if Shade is pursuing me and Bee gets caught up in that, it might very well burn out her abilities. She was very tentative, and I pushed her away. I know I confused her." I stopped. That was enough for him to know. My pain and shame were my own.
"You didn't tell me any of that."
"You were angry." I paused. "So, your turn. What did you dream?" He was quiet. I tried to keep my voice light. "I suppose we both die, again." He drew in a deep breath, and his gloved hand sought my wrist.
"I don't want to sleep, Fitz. I sit up here in the bunk, in the dark both day and night, and I try not to sleep, because I don't want to dream. But I do, and the urge to speak the dreams, to write them down, is so strong it makes me ill. But I cannot write them down,
for I've not enough sight, even if I had ink, and I don't want to tell them to anyone.
Not telling the dreams makes you sick?
It's like an obsession. The true dreams must be spoken and shared, at the very least written down.
He laughed low.
The servants count on that. They harvest the dreams of those poor half-whites like farmers harvesting grapes. Everything goes into their library of dreams and predictions. All is processed, like blowing the chaff from grain. All is preserved, referenced and cross-referenced, ready for them to employ, to see what they can predict and how they can profit from it.
He leaned in hard to me like a child fleeing nightmares, and I put my arm around him to brace him. He shook his head.
Fitz, they will know we are coming. They have B, and they will know we are coming. This can't end well for any of us.
So tell me, don't let me go into this blind. He choked out a laugh.
Oh, no. I'm the one who goes into it blind, Fitz. You die. You drown. In darkness, in cold seawater, and in blood, you drown. There. Now you know. I don't know what good it does us, but you know.
I felt his shoulders slump in the dimness.
And I have the small relief of having told my dreams.
Cold crept through me. My mouth might claim not to believe him, but my guts did. Couldn't I freeze to death? I asked in a falsely light voice. I've heard that you just fall asleep and it's done.
Sorry,
he said, and I heard the same effort in his voice.
I don't get to decide how it happens. I'm simply told it does.
And you?
That's the worst part. I think I live through it.
I had a moment of relief. Then it died. He was not certain of his survival. And B? My voice shook. I know you've dreamed her alive. Do we save her? Does she go home? He spoke hesitantly.
I think she is like you. She is a crossroads of many possible futures. I've seen her wearing a crown with alternating spires of flame and darkness. But she also appears as broken manacles, one who frees things, and as the shattered vessel.
What is the shattered vessel?
Something broken beyond repair,
he said quietly. My child. Molly's daughter, broken beyond repair. Some part of me had known that her experience must do that to her. She would be as broken as the fool and I were. Something inside my chest hurt at the thought. My voice creaked. Well, who wouldn't break? I broke. You broke.
And we both emerged stronger.
We both emerged, I said, modifying his words. I was never sure I understood what Regal's torture had done to me. Part of me had died in that cell, both literally and figuratively. I was alive today. I'd never know if I'd lost more than what I had found. Useless to wonder. What else? I demanded. His head lolled forward slightly, and then twitched up. I changed my question. How long have you been awake?
I don't know. I doze off and then wake, and I don't know how long I've been asleep. Blindness is peculiar, Fitz. No day, no night, and not darkness, if you want to know.
Any other dreams or thoughts you want to share with me?
I dream of a nut that is dangerous to crack. Sometimes I hear a nonsense ditty. The trap is the trapper, and the trapper is trapped. But it isn't always dreams. Sometimes I see, like a crossroads, but one with an infinite number of paths starring away from a center. When I was a youngster, I saw those often and clearly. After you brought me back to life, I didn't see any for a long time, not until B touched me in the market that day. That was incredible. I touched her, and I knew she was the center of a multitude of paths. She saw them, too. I had to draw her back from making too swift a choice.
His voice faltered to a stop. Then what happened? I demanded in consternation. He gave a snort of laughter.
Then I believe you knifed me in the belly. A number of times. But I lost count after two.
Oh. Cold roiled through me. I wasn't sure you recalled any of that. I felt the weight of his body against my shoulder. I'm sorry, I said.
It's too late for that.
He patted me with his gloved hand and straightened up with a sigh.
I've already forgiven you.
What can one say to that? He continued,
Paragon, when I looked up at Paragon as we came into dock at Treehog, he was shining with pathways. There were others there, at that junction, leading back to Kelsingra or into Treehog itself. But most of the ones that led to Clarez, the straightest, shortest ones, began with Paragon.
So that was why you insisted we must stay with him?
Now you believe in me?
I don't want to, but I do.
I feel the same.
Silence claimed us both. I waited. After a time, I realized he was deeply asleep. I moved him gently from my shoulder onto the bunk. I lifted his legs up onto the bed. It reminded me of how I used to put Hap back to bed after his nightmares, all those years ago. The fool pulled his knees in closer to his chest and slept, curled defensively. I sat down again on the edge of the bunk. He would sleep. And he would dream, whether he wished or no. And I would skill. I exhaled slowly, letting my breath blow away my boundaries, and immediately became more aware of the ship. Excuse me, I muttered, as if I had bumped against a stranger in a crowd. Then I ignored his presence and reached out, feeling for the skill current. It was there, but it was calmer than I'd felt it in months. It was as constant as the wind that gently filled the sails and pushed us through the waves. I moved with the skill current, letting it carry my thoughts and will toward Buckkeep and to my daughter, Nettle. She was sleeping. I eased into her dream thoughts, woke her gently. How are you and your child? Shade's dead. The news flew from her mind to mine, drenching me with her urgency that I know. Her grief swept in and woke my as-yet unformed sorrow. For a time, that was all there was. I did not ask her how. He was old. It had been coming for a very long time, deprived of the herbs and kept from the skill that he had been using for so long to rejuvenate himself. His years had caught up to him.
I blame myself. We gave him Delven bark to quench his skill. He had grown so randomly strong with it. He would be calm, and then he was like a cold wind blasting. Two of the new apprentices decided to leave the training because his spells were so frightening. Even Shine had come to dread his moments of strength, for no matter how she deadened herself, he would seize her and tumble her into the skill with him. She was terrified, as were we all. So I authorized the Delven bark. I changed all the pages who had been carrying out his errands. I suspect they were fetching more than food and wine for him. After 3 days of it, it blocked his skill, and he became an old man, kindly but fretful and old. We let him have visits with Shine again. I'd had to keep her away from him. He didn't seem to understand why we had kept his daughter away. He was so confused. He would talk to Shrewd's portrait. Oh, fits. I fear he died thinking I was needlessly cruel, that I had taken his daughter and his magic from him, simply for meanness, simply to control him.
I felt Riddle. He'd heard her crying, I surmised, and woken. I felt him as if he were armor closing around her, hammered metal, holding her in and upright. Anything that wanted to hurt her would have to go through him first. I thought grief had numbed me, but suddenly relief soared in my heart. I am glad Riddle is there with you.
So am I. I'll tell him that.
Did you get our bird messages?
Yes. Shade's message from Lant was clutched in his hand. I don't know how many times Shine read it aloud to him. Fitz, he was smiling when we found him. A calm, sweet smile.
I realized abruptly, I have to tell Lant. Then,
I can't. Your first thought was correct. You must tell him, as I had to tell you.
I will. I didn't know how or when, but I would tell him. And Spark. I wondered if I now understood the fool's compulsion to speak of his dreams. I did not want to tell them, yet I desperately wanted to share the news, as if grief were a heavy burden to be spread out among those who must bear it.
Yes, she agreed, and it's good to know you are alive. I have reached out to you over and over these last few days. When none of us could reach you with the skill, we feared the worst.
I'm on a live ship. His presence is pervasive. Even as I skilled to her, I could feel the ship sharing what I told her. I am sorry to have worried you.
I understand. I will immediately wake Dutiful to tell him.
Then my own news burst from me without warning. The fool has dreamed that B is alive. And the last time I could reach you with the skill, when Shade so abruptly parted us, I felt B. I knew her touch. The winds of all the worlds blew between us, and the shushing of waves whispered against every shore. What news was more shocking, that Shade had died, or B might still live? I felt her shock pour through me.
Where is she? How is she? Have they mistreated her? Does she think we abandoned her? How did she survive passing through that skill stone? How is it possible she lived and we gave up on her for months?
I don't know. That was the torment of it. So much I didn't know. I was not going to tell my pregnant daughter that her small sister was miserable and mistreated. That I would lie about with a clear conscience. I agonized enough for the both of us. I would not put that burden on her.
I just had a brush of her against my senses. I know she is bound for Clarys, as are we. I do not know if she is ahead of us or behind us. Only that she is on a ship bound for Clarys. That was all, and the fool dreamed of her, alive. It's little to go on, but I will take heart from it.
Her thoughts suddenly swept over me, a mistress of war woken.
I will muster an army of warriors and skill users. Eliania has brought up this proposal more than once to me. We will come. We will take back what is ours and leave nothing but ruins and bodies.
No. For now, do not send any vast force in this direction. We think our best chance is to go in quietly.
You will negotiate for her return?
That thought had never even occurred to me. I had set out on a mission of vengeance, planning only to kill. The thought of B in their hands had only made me more determined to see their blood.
I am still on a ship, bound for Clarys. I will decide when I arrive there and study the situation. Perhaps I shall negotiate.
There were many ways to negotiate. Taking hostages immediately sprang to mind. My thoughts went winging off, and I knew that Nettle sensed that.
How are you?
I asked her.
Heavy. Tired. Happy. Sometimes.
Sometimes.
when she was thinking of her baby, rather than the death of Shade, or the torment of her small sister. I'm sorry I woke you, and sorry that Shade is gone. I will tell Lant, and you should rest now. She laughed. Rest, while thinking of little B in the hands of kidnappers. Oh, Da, does life ever become simple? Only for a few moments, my dear. Only for a few moments. I drew myself away from her as if we were unclasping hands. For a time longer, I floated in the skill. I wondered if some remnant of Shade remained in this flow, some ghost of verity, or perhaps even my father. I had encountered presences in the skill. I was not sure what they were, only that they were far larger beings than I was. Larger? Richer, deeper, more fully formed. Ida and El? Ancient elderlings, or skill users who had acquired more presence in that flow? I gathered my courage. B, can you hear me? I formed an image of my little girl in my mind. Little B. I saw her in her old-fashioned clothing. I saw her doubting gaze as she looked up at me. I smelled the fading scent of honeysuckle on a warm summer night. Then I saw all the ways I had failed her. No, this was not helping. I'd never find her that way. I pushed aside reluctance and tried to reconstruct that moment of contact we'd had. With Shade rushing down on us like a summer squall on a small boat, pushing and scattering and threatening.
Fitz, my boy!
An echo in the vast current of skill, a brief recollection of Shade like a perfume on a spring breeze. Dead. Gone. The flood of loss was too much. I tried again to reach for B, but I was groping in dark water. My child was as gone as Shade was. I drew back from the skill current and opened my eyes to the darkness of the fool's chamber. He was sleeping deeply. There was no one else in the room. Sitting on the floor, I pulled my knees up tight to my chest and bowed my head over them. Shade's boy wept. Chapter 23. Clarice. The unexpected sun arrives cloaked in a power that none can see but all can feel. It shimmers and floats and confuses both eye and mind. In my dream, he is one, then two, then three creatures. He opens his cloak and fury burns inside him, flames that make me fall back before their heat. He closes his cloak, and he is gone. An unexpected sun has appeared in various guises and has been dreamed 124 times. In the last 30 years, it has been dreamed 70 times. In every case, the dreamer reported a sense of foreboding. One described it as the cringing servant who expects punishment. Another reported a sense of shame before justice. I have dreamed my own form of the dream of the unexpected sun. I believe it is a dream of justice and punishment to come, brought to those who least expect it, and I have dreamed it more than a dozen times. I believe this dream is an inevitable future. I have studied other dreams of the sun, attempting to find from whence he comes and to whom he brings judgment. In none of the dreams can I find this information. Dream 729 of Della, of the Corathin lineage. Clarice was the strangest place I had ever seen. I stood on the deck, forgetful of my errand for Dwalia, and stared. Ahead of me was a kindly harbour with water that was impossibly blue. All around the harbour there were square buildings of pink and white and pale green, with flat roofs and numerous windows. Some of the buildings had small pointed tents pitched on their roofs. Greenery cascaded down the sides of some, framing the windows. Behind the buildings that fronted the harbour,
The gentle rolling hills beckoned in shades of gold and brown. There were random solitary trees with fat trunks and widespread branches, although on one hillside, even ranks of trees might have been an orchard. The distant hills were speckled with herds of grazing animals. The white and grey ones were probably sheep. The other herd creatures were cattle, of a sort I had never seen, with branching horns and hummocks on their shoulders. The small boats of our ship had been deployed and our sails furled. Bare-chested sailors bent their backs to the oars as they towed us toward the docks. Slowly, so slowly, we drew closer to shore. The terraced city followed a curve of land that embraced the harbour. One arm of the embrace was a long, narrow peninsula, but the peninsula was broken. Beyond that gap, as if it had broken off from the land, was a big island with a dazzling ivory fortress upon it. The island itself was also white, almost blindingly so. Its lumpy shores of tumbled blocks of stone sparkled. Quartz. I'd once found a rock that sparkled like that, and Revel had told me it had quartz in it. All the land outside the fortress walls was barren. Not a tree, no trace of green. It looked to me as if it were an island that had suddenly popped up out of the sea with a magical castle atop it. The outer walls of the castle were tall and crenellated. At each corner a staunch guard tower rose, each topped with a structure like the skull of some immense and fearsome creature. Each of the empty-eyed skulls stared off in a different direction. Within the stone walls, and taller than the walls, a sturdy stronghouse stood, and four slender towers rose from each corner of that, the spires even taller than the castle towers, with bulbous rooms at the top, like the top of an onion left to go to seed. Never had I seen towers so tall and slender, gleaming pale against the blue sky. I stared at it, my destination, my future. Despair tried to rise in me. I pushed it down with frozen stones. I didn't care. I was alone. I would be enough for me. I'd had two dreams since my father had cast me aside. Two dreams that I dared not think about for fear that Vindelire might glimpse them. They had frightened me. Badly. I had woken in the dark of night and stuffed the front of my shirt into my mouth so no one could hear me sobbing. But when I calmed, I understood. I could not see my path clearly, but I knew I had to walk it alone. To Clarez. I had been sent out of Dwalia's stateroom to return a tray of dirty dishes to the galley. Usually she did not choose me for such tasks. I think she intended it as yet another demonstration to Vindelire that I was not only trusted, but quickly becoming her favourite. I had perfected my grovelling servitude and taken it to levels he dared not approach. I radiated repentant loyalty at her in a small, steady stream. It was dangerous, for it meant I must constantly be on my guard against Vindelire, lest he gain entry to my mind. He had grown terribly strong since he had drunk the serpent spit. But he was strong as a bullock was strong, good at large motions and breaking walls. I was not a wall. I was a tiny, rolling pebble, hard as a nut, with no edges for him to grasp. I'd felt him try more than once. I had to keep myself very small and let out only the thoughts that had no real ties to me, like my slavish admiration of Dwalia. I'd carried my pretense well, even to standing by her bath and holding a towel for her, and then stooping to dry her calloused feet and lumpy toes. I'd rub her feet to hear her groan with pleasure, and I'd set out her clothing as if I were garbing royalty rather than draping a hateful old woman. My ability to deceive her almost frightened me, for it involved thinking the thoughts of a defeated slave. Sometimes I feared that those thoughts were becoming my true thoughts. I did not want to be her slave, but living without the threats and the beatings was such a relief that it was almost an acceptance that this was the best life I could hope for. I felt a familiar squeezing in what I thought must be my heart. I had heard of being heartbroken or heavy-hearted, but I had never known it was an actual sensation one felt when the whole world abandons you. I looked out at what I knew must be Clara's and tried to believe I could make a life for myself there. for I knew now I would never go home. I had felt my father's touch upon my mind. I had felt him spurn me, cast me aside so violently that I had woken, shaking and sick. I had reached for Wolffather. He had not understood it any better than I had. So, it was done. I was alone. No one was ever going to come and rescue me. No one cared what had become of me. I had known that for days now, but even more I had known it for every long night that came between those days. During the days when both Dwalia and Vindelire were awake, I had no time to dwell on it. I was too busy defending my thoughts from Vindelire while grovelling to Dwalia and impressing on her how cowed and subservient I was now. During those hours, my father's abandonment was a constant humming pain, as permanent as the restless water that surrounded us. During the days, my survival floated on that sea of hurt. At night, I sank beneath it and drowned in it. My loneliness had become absolute when I had touched minds with my father and he had pushed me away. I had tried to make it less of a rejection in any way I could, but it was like trying to put the pieces of a cup together so it made a teapot. There had been those other voices. One had been my sister's, perhaps, but I was not certain. There had been a chorus of others, including one who shouted and roared. I didn't know how I had reached them, but I knew my father had been aware of me. "Flee," he had bidden me, as if there were danger, but he did not flee with me. He had not caught me up and kept me safe. He had stayed in the middle of that storm of voices. He had paid attention to them, pushing me to one side. When I had dared to call out to him again, he had shoved me roughly away. He had pushed me so hard that I had not been able to hold on to him. I'd fallen away from him, away from my hope of rescue and a return to a life that had some kindness in it. I'd tumbled back into myself, into my lonely, small self, and found Vindelire already sniffing around my boundaries. I had not even dared to weep aloud. I'd slammed my walls tight, tight, tight. Wolffather had warned me. To hold my walls that tight meant no one could reach me. At that moment, I hoped no one would ever touch my thoughts again. I never wanted anyone to like me again, let alone love me. And I was never, ever going to like anyone else. The pain in my heart had suddenly become a pain in my belly. It combined with the hurt of holding the dreams unspoken and unwritten. But the dreams that came to me now, I dared not speak. They were frightening and tantalizing, tempting and terrifying. They called to me to make them real, and with every day of our journey they became more real to me, as if I came ever closer to an inevitable future I would make. I closed my eyes for a moment and then opened them to the pastel city before me. I made myself see how pretty it was, and I imagined myself as a happy person there. I would trot along those streets, greeting the people I knew, running some useful errand for Dwalia, and some day I would escape. No, I could not have that thought, nor that plan. Not yet. It was a lovely place, a wonderful place to call home. How happy I was to be here. I trickled out a bit of that thought. I had discovered that I could feed such things to Dwalia even when I couldn't see her. Her mind was a shape I knew now, as was Vindelire's. Experimentally, I dribbled a bit of my imaginary happiness onto him. For a moment, I felt him warm, and then he slapped my thought away. He did not know how to make his thoughts reach me clearly. Sometimes they did, but I think that was something that happened, rather than something he knew how to do. I did not hear his direct thoughts, but I felt his distrust of me. And behind his distrust, his hurt. Somehow, he had truly believed that I would become his brother and love him as no one else ever had. He had seen a path for us that I never had. For a moment, the stinging thought that perhaps he felt as abandoned as I did shamed me. Then I crushed it down and shut it out of my mind. No. He had helped to kidnap me, had aided in destroying my home, and had tricked and helped kill the only person who had befriended me on my horrible journey. He had no right to think anyone would love him for doing those things. But fury was a strong emotion, and I was learning that strong emotions made cracks in my wall. I denied my hatred. It made my stomach hurt worse than ever. But I did it. I turned my eyes to the pretty city with the little rectangular houses like little cakes displayed on a shelf. I would have a delicious life here. I put a cheery smile on my face and carried my tray to the galley and left it there. As I made my way back to the captain's stateroom, I had to dodge hurrying sailors. As we neared our destination, the number and pace of their tasks were increasing. One of them cursed at me as I skipped out of his way. Small boats were hastening toward us as our sailors secured the gathered sails. Coiled lines awaited. The little boat would tow us into the docks. Our arrival was imminent. I tapped on the stateroom door in case the captain was making a last-minute visit and heard Dwalia's charming request that I should enter.
"Pack it all up,"
she commanded me as soon as she saw me. She gestured at the scattered garments that she had tried on and then discarded. Every time we had stopped in a port, the captain had purchased more garments for her. I wondered what she would do with them all once we disembarked and she was no longer Lady Obricia. She herself was occupied with carefully setting the jewelry she had acquired onto a finely woven scarf, also gifts from her captain. Once she had them arranged, she rolled the scarf up, folding the ends in as she went, and then tying it into a small bundle. By then, I was nearly finished layering her gauzy and lacy finery into a trunk. "Will you be sad to leave him?" The question had popped into my head and out of my mouth. At her sudden scowl, I hastily added, "He treats you so well, it must be gratifying to have someone recognize your true value." She narrowed her eyes at me. It had been a bit too complimentary, but I made my querying face as bland as possible and then turned away to finish fastening the buckles of the trunk. I managed a sideways glance at Vindelire. He was very slow, gathering his meager possessions and stuffing them into a worn bag. Since I had become Dwalia's favorite, she had asked less and less of him. I had imagined he might be grateful to have fewer tasks, but her ignoring of him only fueled his dislike of me. I had the uneasy feeling that he was planning something. But if he was, he had kept it well concealed. I, too, had a plan, one that was slowly taking shape in my mind. I dared not dwell on it, lest he catch some flavor of it in my thoughts. It was the first plan that I should have made, back in winter when they had first captured me. No, don't think about it in front of them when they are awake. I reminded myself again of the little pastel houses and what an agreeable life awaited me in this pretty city. Dwalia responded at last.
"I shall be sad to leave him."
Then she took a deep breath and squared her shoulders.
"But this is not my life. I do not depend on a man's position and affection to claim what should be mine."
She sounded almost angry that she had been well treated by him. She turned to Vindelire.
"You remember what you are to do as we disembark?"
"Yes."
His agreement was sullen. She cocked her head slightly at him.
"And you are certain you can do it?"
"Yes."
His eyes flickered to me, and I knew a moment of unease.
"Fine."
She stood, straightened her dress and patted at her hair. I had braided it for her that morning and coiled it carefully at the back of her head. Now she smoothed it, as if she were the lovely woman the captain imagined her to be. Sparkling earrings dangled, and a network of silver rings dotted with tiny sparkling jewels caged her throat. But above it was her plain, round face, ruined forever by the scar my teeth had left. From what I had read in my father's scrolls, I suspected that Farseer skill magic could repair her face, but I did not tell her that. It might be a negotiating chip I would need later, an offer that might keep me alive, or at least make her curious enough to let me live a bit longer. I tried to recall how kindly she had seemed the first time I met her, how motherly and solicitous. Vindelire's magic. Vindelire dared a question.
"Do they know we are returning, Simph and Felody?"
She was silent, and I thought she would not reply.
Then she said, "Sending short bird messages would just have confused them. I will explain myself when I stand before them."
He took in a little breath, as if that frightened him.
"They will be surprised to see we are alone."
"Alone?" she snapped. "We bring with us the prize I said we would gain, the unexpected sun."
Vindalaya slid his eyes sideways to look at me. We both knew she no longer believed that. I thought he would have the sense to be quiet, but instead he said,
"But you know B's a girl."
She bawled a fist at him.
"That doesn't matter. Stop talking about things you are too stupid to understand. I will handle this. I will deal with all of it. You will tell no one she is a girl. You will not speak at all. Do you understand me? That should not be too difficult for your feeble mind. Just don't talk."
He parted his lips, then nodded dumbly and emphatically. Dwalia went to the window and stared out at the endless blue sea. Did she wish she was not going home? In the few extra minutes in which Dwalia did not busy me, I did my best to smooth my hair. I managed to dabble my hands in her used washwater and wipe my face with the cloth before I bore it away. Wear had not improved my garments, but they were reasonably clean. I made a sack out of my worst shirt and put my few spare garments inside it. I tied the sleeves together to make a handle and slung it over my shoulder. I had chosen my disguise. I would be an honest child, standing straight before all, harmless and intent on pleasing Dwalia. Let no one fear or suspect what I truly was. We heard the shouts of the sailors and the noises of the town had grown louder. The little boats would tow us right up to the docks that fingered out from the busy streets. Between us, Vindalaya and I managed to carry the trunk full of Dwalia's fine garments up to the deck. Dwalia tucked the packet of jewelry into a lovely embroidered bag that she carried, and there on the deck we stood, mostly out of the sailors' way, and waited for the ship to reach the dock and be safely moored to it, and then for the gangplank to be put into place. Only then did the captain come to us. He took both Dwalia's hands in his, kissed her chastely on her cheek, and told her that he had already sent a runner ahead to secure lodgings for her in a clean and honest inn. Regretfully, he said, he could not accompany us, but he had two strong men who would carry her trunk and escort her to the place. He promised that he would come with her to Clara's castle to consult on her future, for he hoped he would figure large in such a reading. Lady Obricia simpered and thanked him. The elegant arched plumes on her hat bobbed in the sea breeze. She reminded him that she had business of her own to conduct in Clara's, but she would see him that evening, and her two servants could manage to take her trunk to the lodgings, so no escort was needed. For a moment, his brow was wrinkled in concern for his darling. Then the lines smoothed as I felt Vindalaya manipulate his mind. Of course she would be fine. He would not worry for her. She was as competent as she was lovely, and he cherished her independent spirit. Even so, he accompanied us down the gangplank. He again took Dwalia's hands in his and looked down at her as she tilted her head back to meet his fond gaze.
"Be careful, my lovely," he cautioned her, and stooped to take a final kiss.
I felt Vindalaya do it. He dropped the illusion as the captain's face neared hers and let him see her as she was. His intended kiss did not reach her mouth as he recoiled from her. In less than a breath, Vindalaya had restored her glamour. But by then the captain had stumbled back a step. He blinked, rubbed his eyes with the palms of both his hands, and then smiled at Dwalia sheepishly.
"I've been awake too long. I stand on land and feel giddy from the stillness. Lady Obricia, I will see you later this evening. We shall dine together."
"We shall," she promised him faintly.
He turned his head, rubbed his brow, and made his way back up to his ship. He looked back at us from the deck of his ship, and she lifted a lace-gloved hand to wave at him. He grinned like a boy, waved back, and turned to his duties. For a moment longer, she stood staring after him. Hurt made her homely face even plainer.
Vindelire stood innocently by, feigning that he did not know what had just happened, but...
"He saw me,"
Dwalia said in a low, accusing voice.
"You allowed him to see me."
Vindelire looked off into the distance.
"Perhaps for an instant my control faltered."
He shifted his gaze back to her, and then away. I saw his vicious satisfaction, but perhaps it was too fleeting for her to catch.
"It takes a great deal of strength to maintain such an illusion,"
he pointed out to her.
"The captain is not a gullible man. To make his crew see you as Lady Obricia was hard. To make the captain see you in such a different form, in every moment he was with you, has near drained my magic. Perhaps now is the time when you should give me..."
"Not here," she snapped. She glared at both of us. "Pick up that trunk and follow me."
Vindelire took one end, and I seized the other handle, and we walked behind her. The trunk was not that heavy. Carrying it was only awkward because Vindelire was such a weakling. He kept shifting his grip from hand to hand, and he walked leaning over, as if he could barely lift it. The trunk bumped and skipped on the paving stones and knocked against my hip and calf. Every 100 paces or so, Dwalia had to stop and wait for us to catch up with her. Vindelire strove to maintain her appearance. Men were halting to cast admiring looks at her. Two women exclaimed to each other over her hat and dress. She walked proudly, and when she glanced back at us, there was a pleased light in her eyes I had never seen before. We walked down streets crowded with folk foreign to my eyes, sailors and merchants and workers, I guessed them to be, but in all manner of garb and of all different colourings. I saw a boy with hair as red as rust, his hands and arms speckled with freckles, like a bird's egg. There was a woman taller than any person I'd ever glimpsed, and her bare brown arms were sheathed all over in white tattoos, from her fingertips to her wide shoulders. A bald little girl in a pink frock skipped beside her equally bald mother, whose lips were framed with tiny jewels. I turned my head, wondering how the jewels stayed on, and the trunk hit my calf on top of an earlier bruise. I felt Vindelire struggling to carry the trunk and maintain Lady Obricia's illusion. The third time Dwalia had to stop and wait for us, she said,
"I see you are becoming useless again. Very well, you need not try so hard. For now, I wish folk to not notice us. That is all."
"I will try."
Her beauty fell away from her. She became ordinary, and less than ordinary, not worthy of notice. Dwalia trudged through the crowds, and people grudgingly gave way to her, and we lurched along after her. I could feel Vindelire's magic failing. I glanced over at him. His power sputtered and danced like a dying flame on a damp log.
"I can't,"
he gasped, and gave up his efforts. Dwalia glared at him. I wondered if she knew he no longer cloaked her. But as we tottered along behind her, folk began to notice her. I saw a woman wince at the scar on her cheek. A little boy took his finger from his mouth and pointed it at her. His mother shushed him and hurried him along. Twice, pale folk stopped and turned toward her as if they might greet her, but she didn't even pause for them. Folk stared at her, and she must have known they saw her as she truly was. One grey-bearded sailor gave a caw of dismay at the sight of her.
"A feather bonnet on a pig!"
he said to his swarthy companion as they passed, and both guffawed. Dwalia halted in the street. She did not look back at us as we caught up with her, but spoke over her shoulder.
"Leave it. There is nothing in that trunk that I'll ever wear again. Just leave it."
She reached up and tore free the pins that had secured her hat, threw it to the ground, and strode away. I was stunned. I'd heard tears in her voice. Vindelire dropped his end of the trunk with a thud. It took longer for me to realize she was serious. She didn't look back at us. She stumped away from us, and we were both panting when we finally caught up with her. I was quickly aware that I had not trotted or even walked much in our days aboard the ship. Her pace meant that I had little time to look around. I had only glimpses of a well-kept city with wide, uncluttered streets. The people we passed were clean, and their clothing was simple but whole. The women's skirts were wide-belted at the waist, and the loose folds came scarcely to their knees. They wore sandals, and their blouses